America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin. Welcome back to America Trends. Christianity was born in the ancestral lands of the Middle East. It thrived there for centuries, but is now at risk of being lost to new generations still inhabiting these historic and holy lands. We in the West often think of the Middle East in terms of the Islamic faith, the Shia and the Sunni, and the conflict between Jews and Palestinians. We spend little time focused on the dwindling number of Christians still living there, whose faith is being threatened in different ways in various countries. Let's put the story in historical context and bring you up to date on what's happening there. That's all today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Janine DiGiovanni, and she's written a remarkable book called The Vanishing: Faith, Loss, and the Twilight of Christianity in the Land of the Prophets. And Janine, I know you're a longstanding journalist. You're somebody who's been in many war zones throughout your lifetime. And you begin this particular book talking about the decline of Christianity and the threats to it in the Middle East. But you begin in Paris, and you seem to be in a rather melancholy mood. The shadow over the book as you segue to the disappearance of Christian communities in the Middle East. How important was it, the timing? I know you've been working on this book for about a five-year period, I believe.
What happened was that, I started working in the Middle East about 35 years ago, and I was always really fascinated by the minorities in the Middle East, particularly Christians in the Holy Land. One of the reasons for this is I just found it absolutely extraordinary that they had existed for so long as minorities, particularly in Iraq and Syria and places where they were unwanted or where they really faced persecution and discrimination. About 5 years ago, well, 2015, I'd say, so a bit longer, I finished my book about Syria, which was called The Morning They Came for Us. And that was about the Syrian war and largely human rights violations. Mm-hmm. But there was a piece missing, and that piece was something I always wanted to write about, which was about the Christians in Syria and in Iraq. So I began the research. I was then at the Council on Foreign Relations and later at Yale, and I went back and forth doing field work in Egypt, Gaza, Syria, and Iraq. And I chose these four communities because they were the most, I thought, vulnerable and in danger of extinction. And then I finally finished my field work. I had my pile of notebooks, and I was sitting down to write, and the pandemic hit. And I was in France. My son is French. I was dropping him off for spring break with his dad, and we were locked down for the next 6 months in a very rural village where my ex-husband's family come from and have done for 400 years. Now, they're devout Catholics, so it was a really beautiful and haunting environment where I sat down to begin the initial stages of the book. And also, of course, hanging over us was this pandemic, which at the beginning was terrifying because we didn't know what was happening.
And you exhibit great, deep faith in this book. You are a believer. How important was that for you in the process of kind of uncovering and excavating what's happening to Christians in the Middle East?
Well, my belief and my faith has gone through great periods of not at all to very profound to now a kind of like steady. I've always believed in God, and I've always believed in what I was brought up to believe, the goodness, the good parts of Christianity. I always rebelled against the things which didn't suit me, divorce or the laws against homosexuality or things that I felt were just outdated and too mm-hmm. strict. And in my own way, you know, I believe God doesn't believe in these things either. But my faith was hugely important in this because while I can't identify with Christians in, let's say, Egypt who are persecuted, in just being able to find a church in, let's say, Minya province, or Christians in Gaza who truly are being, you know, are in danger of extinction, I feel like there was a common thread between all of us, which I've always felt wherever I worked in the world, whether it was Bosnia or Africa, whenever I went to a church, because there is this common thread of people who are believers.
It's interesting that you do focus a bit, of course, on Gaza, and that's really pretty a remarkable place. And Gaza gets very little attention, I think, when we think about what's happening to Christians in that particular region. The Palestinian Authority is, not only doing not enough, seemingly, to promote any religious equality, but they are also seizing a lot of Christian land, taking it for themselves. And yet what we hear over here in the United States is what's going on between the Muslims and the Jews. We hear so little about what's happening to the Christians.
Well, I would kind of retract what you say and say it's the Israeli government and the settlers who are stealing land from Palestinians much more than the Palestinian Authority going after Christians. I mean, mm-hmm. as we speak, Jewish mm-hmm. settlers are, you know, attacking Palestinian villages and Israeli peacemakers to try to take their land. So I've worked there for a very long time, and I think Gaza, what's interesting about the Gaza Christians is that I didn't even know there was a population there. There are 800, which is shrunk from the 4th century when Gaza was entirely Christian. And I believe, you know, their greatest threat is what every Gazan faces, all 2 million, the constant Israeli bombing, which absolutely decimates their water systems, their sense of security. Now, they are trapped between Hamas and the Israeli government, but it's the Israeli government that is laying the siege on Gaza, which is cruel, punitive, and collective punishment. It does not allow them to go to Bethlehem to be with their relations at Christmas or Easter. It does not give them freedom of movement. It does not let Christians, as well as Muslims, go to study when they get scholarships to Harvard or Syracuse University, as many of my friends did. It's a cruel collective punishment that's been going on since 2007, and the Christians there suffer alongside the other 2 million Gazan residents.
Yeah, and since I raised it, let me go back in. The Israeli occupation certainly takes a lot of the blame for the Christian exodus. As you say, Bethlehem has been besieged during the second yeah. Intifada, and the Israeli army killed Christians as well as Muslims. But the Israelis seemingly were after them because they're Palestinians, not because they're Christians necessarily. Just explain, what is daily life there like for a Christian?
In Gaza?
Yeah.
Well, the way that they live and the people that they are, you know, a tiny minority in the Gaza Strip, which is 7 miles by 14 miles and 2 million people live there. They are this ancient community, so they stay, but their freedom of movement is absolutely restricted in that they can't leave if they do want to go to Bethlehem for Christmas or Easter. Easter, Lent is coming up. It's an important Christian holiday. They feel, the Gazan Christian community was the most difficult one for me to penetrate. And mm-hmm. I feel it's because they're afraid of Hamas, but they're equally afraid of the Israeli punitive measures, meaning that they won't get visas to visit their family. Their lives are very, very difficult. They have electricity cuts only a few hours a day. They have water shortages. Gaza is a humanitarian catastrophe. It was the UN said way back in 2014 that by 2021 it would be unlivable, and it's now 2022. So, and yet despite this, I love Gaza. I really, really love this place because I find the people the most resilient, extraordinary people I've ever met. Some of the most brilliant, the young generation. I just wrote a big piece in Vanity Fair, which is out this month, called Generation Gaza. The young people are, they speak many languages, they are entrepreneurs, they are resilient, they are trying their best to live in a crippling siege. And the Christians are part of this.
Take us back to the issue of the maps and artificial countries that were built around agreements from Western nations, and how that puts us in much of the position that we're in today.
If you look at Iraq and you think post-World War I, when the map of modern Iraq was drawn by British diplomats, or even going back to Sykes-Picot, these are countries where you have, let's look at Iraq as an example, 65% Shia, the rest Sunni, and a mixture of minorities, including the Christians, but many other minorities. They were separate countries. You know, you could easily divide up Iraq today as Kurdistan. Let's not forget the Kurds, who, of course, are a stateless people who have been yearning for a homeland for generations and have been betrayed continuously by the West. You have the Sunnis and you have the Shias. And, of course, the Shias look more towards Iran as their spiritual home. And the Sunnis were, of course, governed by Saddam Hussein throughout his time. He himself was a Sunni. The Shias were brutally punished. And then after the American invasion, it turned. The Shias were in power. The Sunnis were punished, and the Sunni insurgency rose up. So we basically, without us going into a massive history lesson, the maps that were drawn post-World War I, and including the map of Israel, now, of course, I believe Israel absolutely has a right to exist, but I think the war in 1948, which the Palestinians call the Nakba catastrophe, displaced them from their land, and they do have a right to return. You know, there are people that still have the keys to their homes where they were expelled by the then nascent Israeli forces and Israeli terrorist groups that pushed them off their land. So, look, we in the West made a big mess of the Middle East, and then we abandoned them, like the Syrian war, for instance, 2013, when Assad chemically gassed his own people. President Obama promised action. That was the red line, and yet he withdrew. And Syria today is in its 11th year of war. That's the lifespan of a child. I mean, it's you know, our cynicism towards the Middle East has been profound, and it's the effect of it is what we are seeing today, the series of wars and conflicts and even climate change, which is drastic there. These are all things we really have to look at.
Do you think we are in the West paying enough attention? I don't think we are. I don't think we hear about it on any regular basis. Your book is so important for that reason. The book is called The Vanishing. I mean, when we do look at the situation there, what is the United Nations doing? And do you think that perhaps because we have such a schism in the United States as it relates to fundamentalist Christians, and
yes,
in fact,
exactly,
they may be some of the greatest proponents for the Christian cause and the difficulties in the Middle East, that there are many in the more liberal community, and I would consider myself among those, who may not pay enough attention because it's their issue.
So you just raised many, many points. Let's start with the evangelical Christians. Yes, they do draw attention to the plight of Christians in the Middle East, but they often do it for the wrong reasons. First of all, the evangelical community are aligned with President Trump, as we know, and they are aligned with the Jewish settler movement, which aims to push Palestinians off their land, such as Sheikh Jarrah right now going on in Jerusalem. They also, as proponents of the Muslim ban, President Trump's Muslim ban back in 2017, I feel like it set a terrible precedent, which was that we have good refugees and bad refugees. Good refugees are Christians, so they're welcome to come. Bad refugees are Muslims, they cannot come. So as someone that's worked with refugees my entire career, I was terribly worried about this. I was also terribly worried the evangelical community, and indeed the far-right Jewish community, would pick up my book as evidence of the fact that Muslims and Christians cannot live together, and that extremist groups such as ISIS were intent on killing Christians. Okay, it is true that ISIS kicked out Christians as well as Yazidis, as their main target of part of their belief that they want to, you know, to go back to a very pure Islam. But they also went after non-pious Muslims. Mm-hmm. And Muslims and Christians have lived together for 2,000 years in harmony in many places. So I was really careful to point out that this was not a book which was saying Jews, Christians, and Muslims cannot live together, because I personally don't believe that. I think they absolutely have done, and they can again. Now, your second point, we don't pay enough attention to the Middle East. You know, I grew up during the Lebanese Civil War. I was a little kid when it was going on, growing up in America. And I remember, you know, just catching bits on television and remembering how unbelievably complicated it was. The Middle East wars are not easy to comprehend. Iraq is not easy. The insurgency wasn't easy. Syria was one of the most complicated wars I've ever reported, next to Bosnia, because so many different factions, geopolitics, but also sheer cynicism. So what I think happens basically is people turn off and they just think, oh gosh, I really care about Syrian refugees, but I just don't, I'm not intelligent enough, or I'm not worldly enough to understand the roots of this. And the reason I write my books is that I don't write them for academics and scholars of the Middle East. I write them for people who want to know more and want to know how they can help and want to know what is going on over there. I really do think, Larry, that's one of the reasons people turn off in the Middle East. As for American foreign policy, that's a different issue. I mean, I think President Obama, who I love, did something terrible back in 2013 when he did not punish President Assad for chemically gassing his own people. He opened the door to Russia. So Russia joined the war in 2015 in Syria. And from that moment on, President Putin not only wants a foot in Ukraine, he really, really wants a foot in the Middle East, and he got it. The U.S. created a vacuum, which Russia has now filled. If you look at the negotiations in Syria, the U.N. is paralyzed. They tried to do something, but they've been absolutely paralyzed because Russia and China are on the Security Council, and they veto every kind of humanitarian action. But right now, Russia is basically running the negotiations for Syria. So this is where we are in terms of foreign policy.
When we think about the Uyghurs, let's say, in China, and they've been getting a good deal of attention, but not necessarily a lot of action.
Not enough,
Yeah, I did ask you about the UN role in the Middle East to protect the Christians there, and you just talked about the Security Council, but has there been enough from the humanitarian side of the UN saying that what's going on there is a slow motion tragedy or something of that nature? Do we hear much about the plight of Christians from the United Nations?
No, not at all. Because I think, I think they can't really differentiate between, if they're looking, let's say the UN Refugee Agency, let's say they're looking at, you know, the plight of refugees in the Middle mm-hmm. East, it's Syrian, they're not going to, it would not be right for them to say there's Christian refugees and there's Muslim refugees. But I think the UN, you know, UNESCO does have a freedom of expression division, but the UN really hasn't done much on this. More has come from the Vatican. Pope Francis has been remarkable. I am a huge fan of his. I'm going to meet him March 23rd. I'm thrilled to bits by this. And I think when he went to Iraq last year, at the height of COVID, he did more to raise awareness of the plight of these people than anyone has. He's frail. He's elderly. He was advised by everyone not to go to Iraq. It was COVID. Iraqis most of them don't have vaccines. Not that they don't want to, that they don't have access to them. And he went and he said mass. And that showed the people there a huge, huge symbol and message that they are not alone and that we have got your back. I think that is what Pope Francis said. We've got your back. We are watching. You are not alone. That is psychologically a massive step, because I think what most people feel when they're caught in these terrible situations is that they're completely alone and the West is not paying attention.
Janine D. Giovanni is with us. The book is called The Vanishing Faith, Loss, and the Twilight of Christianity in the Land of the Prophets. Would people find it shocking, surprising, utterly amazing that, in fact, some of the Christians that we're talking about were treated better under some of the brutal regimes of the past than they are under some of these more insurgent groups and others within the Muslim community within the Middle East?
Absolutely. I mean, Larry, I was shocked at this. I worked in Saddam Hussein's Iraq for many years, and I, you know, one thing that's really interesting is that the Christians were protected by Saddam. And the same for Bashar al-Assad. These are brutal dictators, and Mubarak in Egypt. And yet the Christians sought their protection in exchange for votes, of course. I mean, there is no policy on this. There's no, I think you'd find it hard to find, even if you did a census of it, but it definitely is a pattern and something that happened. And I think the reason for this is that Saddam certainly protected minorities, although not the Kurds and not the Yazidis. He loathed them and persecuted them, but Christians certainly. Now, Assad is an Alawite, which is a branch of Shia, a kind of mystical branch of the Shia faith. But he has always protected Christians, and Christians in turn have supported Assad, and the same for Mubarak. So it is a very interesting phenomenon. And I myself, you know, having worked there for years and years, always find it really interesting and curious.
You say in the book that there is more discrimination and persecution often in certain places rather than being hunted down or eradicated. You say that Iraq and Syria are the two places where today you think the situation is different, that Christians are most threatened, and less so in Egypt. Just kind of help us understand this.
Well, in Egypt, the Copts are, I would say, discriminated. And certainly in Minya, provinces like that, they are persecuted. Their churches are burned down. Their churches are locked up. They're scorned. They're dragged through the streets. They're killed. They're firebombed on buses going to monasteries. The Egyptian constitution actually has within it laws that stop Copts from holding high positions in the military or the government. But I don't think they have the same, they under, let's say, what the Christians in Iraq and Syria went through with ISIS, who rolled through, of course, in 2014. Their villages were burnt, their churches were destroyed, their women were taken away, they were killed in high numbers, and they constantly live under the threat that they can be completely eradicated. I have talked to social scientists who say within 100 years, there will not be Christian communities in Iraq. And I've been told by people in Lebanon, bishops, who said 100 years is optimistic. It's more like 40 years. Now, I don't think that would happen in Egypt, largely because there's a large percentage of Copts who are in Cairo, who are wealthy, who are educated, who are very much a part of the society. But if you go to Minya in Upper Egypt, it's an entirely different story. They're poor, they're remote, and they are very much discriminated. But I would say, you know, my biggest worry, if I had to place it somewhere, would be Gaza, then Iraq, then Syria. That's how I would rank it.
I was reading a blogger and activist who was a leading figure in the 2011 revolution in Egypt, Mikhail Nabil Sanad, and he said the Copts, and again, folks, those are Christians, never thought about them being the next in line. What happened to the Jews is happening to the Christians, only more slowly because there are so many of them. And when you look at Jewish purges in some of the same countries that we're talking about, is it fair to call it a dress rehearsal?
Yeah, I mean, I always think back to the incredibly vibrant Jewish Iraqi community. The Jewish community of Baghdad was so important to the social fabric, the cultural fabric, the intellectual fabric, the merchants. And by the 70s, they were gone. I mean, when I was working in 2003, a friend of mine tried to hunt down the last families, because he himself came from an Iraqi Jewish family. You know, I think there's one or two families that are still left but live in great fear. But one thing we should say is the creation of the State of Israel in 1948 lured many of those Jewish communities away. It was certainly persecution and certainly Saddam Hussein's cruelty. But the state of Israel was created and Jewish communities disappeared. The same thing happened in the remote Jewish state of Birobidzhan, which is far east of the former Soviet Union. That was a vibrant place where Yiddish theater thrived and where Yiddish literature. And, you know, after 1948, the people left and went to, why would you live on the edge of Mongolia when you could live in the land of milk and honey in Israel? So I think the creation of the state of Israel also plays a role in that.
Let me ask you about, of course, you did not include Lebanon in the book, and that is such a unique situation. Explain that, you know, simply to us, how apart from the situation that we're talking about in some of these other countries is in Lebanon.
Well, Lebanon, I'd have to write a whole other book about. So I deliberately left Lebanon out because Christians in Lebanon are very much, they have their own issues, absolutely, as do right now. Lebanon is in a terrible state, and my heart breaks for it and for my friends there. It's really suffering. But Lebanese Christians are very much a part of the, you know, the constitution gives them rights in the government to hold positions in the, you know, in it within the upper realms of government. They're very much a part of the mix of the Shia, Sunni, Druze, Christian community. They're much more assimilated and much more, I would say, a part of the economic, political, and social fabric, whereas Christians in Iraq are absolutely minorities and treated as minorities and are in much more vulnerable and much more endangered.
When we see a lot of refugees leaving the Middle East, often going into Eastern Europe, and of course we've seen some of the controversies surrounding the inclusion of peoples from the Middle East into Europe, where are the Christians in that mix?
Christian refugees fleeing, well, the Syrian war, most of the people that fled, 5 to 6 million refugees, were largely Sunni, because of course Assad is Alawite and Shia. So they, by, there were Shia refugees, absolutely, but most of them were Sunni, which, again, when they fled to Lebanon, Lebanon already had massive issues, and they had a huge influx of Palestinian refugees after 1948, remember, who went to Lebanon. So that Sunni demographic of refugees in Lebanon caused somewhat of an imbalance. And there was very unfair treatment of the refugees in Lebanon by some locals who felt that, you know, whenever something went wrong, even if it was electricity cuts or if there was violence, they blamed it on the refugees. Now, remember, they've been there 11 years. And the camps in Lebanon are not called camps, they're called settlements. And the reason for that is that the Lebanese authorities don't want them to stay. They want them to go home. But people cannot go home. Refugees cannot return to their countries until it is safe, and it's not safe yet.
Our Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, says that we have a moral responsibility, America's role. Of course, we started a lot of the most recent deadly cycle. Do you think Americans really think about our role, and are we just glad to have gotten out as messy as the last exit from Afghanistan was?
I think most Americans don't think about it. I think that they're more concerned with COVID. They're more concerned with the inflation. They're more concerned with getting their kids through school masked or unmasked. They're more concerned with vaccines. I mean, people tend to focus on their own immediate neighborhood, community issues. And I do understand that. But I do think that we need to have a bigger picture, because what my book is about ancient people in their ancestral lands who need to be protected. They can only be protected by policies which are put in place which can help them. So, you know, it doesn't take a lot to read my book to understand what's going on there and then to, in some way, pressure governments to act more to protect these people. President Mike Pence is an evangelical Christian. He actually had a huge interest in this part of the world. So you know, I'm very grateful to him for what he did. I'm not grateful for him aligning with Trump, but I'm grateful for him for his interest in these people. And by the way, he turned out to be not such a bad guy after January 6th. So.
Let me ask you, in the book, I need, this is serious. The final days of the people in the cradle of Christianity. I deal in social political trends, primarily in the United States, but this affects the United States. The United States certainly has had a role in where the Middle East is today in so many facets of life there. If current trends continue, some say that in the next several decades, we could witness the death of Christianity in the very lands where it was born. How optimistic, pessimistic are you? You do end the book on a more hopeful note.
One thing I've witnessed from my years of working in war zones is that people are remarkably resilient. Now, these Christians, ISIS was probably the most brutal thing I've witnessed in my lifetime. You know, their cruelty, the speed at which they could recruit. And by the way, ISIS are not dead, despite President Trump's proclamations. They are still alive in northeast Syria and other places. They are still recruiting. I believe they opened Pandora's box to a whole generation of young believers who are on the outside of society, such as in France or the UK, where Muslims really are, you know, could not find a foothold in society. Anyway, these people rebounded from that. They've survived purges. They've survived plagues. They've survived armies that have tried to destroy them. And they're still there. And they still believe. And they still go to church. And they still pray. And that, I think I end my book by saying the word that they constantly use is love. So I do end it on a hopeful note. I am worried. I am deeply concerned they could be eradicated. But I also believe that faith is stronger than anything. So I think that's how I'd like to end this talk as well. Just that, and today is Valentine's Day. So, you know, it essentially is about love.
Janine D. Giovanni, I love your spirit. I love your intelligence and your awareness. The Vanishing, Faith, Loss, and the Twilight of Christianity in the Land of the Prophets. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for a wonderful talk. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you, Janine.